This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana, originating from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge, Robin Dow producing, and we start with Jose Vargas. Many of us remember his heroics as an LSU basketball player in the late 1980s. He played for the Tigers of Dale Brown from 1984 to 1988. He's a native of the Dominican Republic, and he has logged most of his life there. He returned home, hasn't been to Baton Rouge that much. In fact, this is his first visit in about 25 years to his old stomping ground at Tigertown. And good morning to you, Jose Vargas.
Thanks so much for having me on your talk show.
Well, it's always nice to hear your voice, and it has been a few years. As I noted, you played for LSU 84 to 88. Jose was a second-round pick in the NBA draft, the 49th overall pick by the Dallas Mavericks. And he did play professionally from 1988 to 2006, so he had a long career. And he's now 61, just made 61 on the 23rd of June. And I haven't had the chance to see you in person yet, but I hear you're still quite a physical specimen, Jose. You've always kept yourself in shape, haven't you?
Yes, I try to keep myself in shape. And, you know, it's very important to understand or keep our eating habit, you know, regulated so we don't gain too much weight. So I try to keep myself in shape and work out and run and play a little basketball every now and then.
Well, you're 6'10", and I know some guys your height who played basketball and were about in the low 200s when they were playing for LSU are now in the mid 300s. What are you towing the scales at right now, Jose?
Well, no, I keep the same weight. I mean, still at 225, the same weight when I was playing. So as I told you, we need to keep doing exercises and regulate our eating habits. You know, we don't burn as much calorie as we used to, so we need to consume less calorie, you know.
Yeah. Well, how did you end up at LSU? I know Dale Brown, your coach, he had a worldwide recruiting operation, but you came from the Dominican Republic. What prompted you to head this way as a young man?
Well, LSU have a player by the name of Greg Cook, and he went to play in the Dominican Republic. And he became a good friend of mine. I was a kid over there. And he started talking to me about LSU 2 or 3 years before I actually came to LSU. So by Greg Cook and then Dale Brown went to visit over there in the Dominican Republic. He saw me playing and they offered me a scholarship. And I'm happy I came to LSU, very happy.
Well, it was a case in which you played for some great teams. 85, LSU won the SEC championship. 86, mm-hmm. went to the Final Four. And mm-hmm. in 87, came within a basket of returning to the Final Four. So those were some heady times, weren't they?
Yeah, it was. I mean, 84, 88, that was a great period, the greatest time of my life, you know, and was talking to Coach Mao about that, and we have some good team, and the good thing about it is that we have like a brotherhood going on. All the team members, you know, I got in here yesterday, and most of them have called me, have talked to me, Nakira, Ed Wilson, Ricky Blanton, and many others, you know, they all call and say hello, and it's like that brotherhood keep going. You know?
How much of an influence was Dale Brown on your life?
Oh, man, he has all the influence on my life. He molded what I am today, you know. I'm a product of the Dale Brown philosophy. And the most important thing that Coach Brown always taught all of us that God doesn't make any junk and all of us are important. And we need to give ourselves that importance and work really hard to achieve our goals, and I'm a product of the Dale Brown philosophy.
Well, you, like Dale Brown, have traveled the world. You even played for a couple of years in Israel, didn't you?
Yes, sir. I played 3 years in Israel. I traveled all over the world, and I was telling Coach Brown the most important thing that I have a laptop on my baggage today. I speak, read, and write 7 different languages. You know, that's great.
So you got a good education at Louisiana State University.
Exactly, exactly. I got a good foundation at Louisiana. And over here at Louisiana, I learned the greatness of preparing yourself for life. You know, God give all of us the same thing. It's life. The only thing, he doesn't tell any one of us how much he gave us. So we got to, like, live every day like if it would have been our last day, and keep hope and keep faith that there will be a tomorrow. So therefore, we need to keep preparing ourselves all the time for tomorrow. So that's what I've been doing in my life, and that's come from the LSU Foundation.
Steve Myers, the founder of Tiger Rag, and I were talking about you, and he reminded me that Dale Brown, when he was coach, took his team with you to Angola, and Steve remembers you sitting in the electric chair. Do you recall that?
Yes, sir. That's so important. I mean, many coaches don't bother to teach their kid and to show the other side of life, because when you come to a school like LSU, you really live in the bubble, you know. But Coach Brown, he have the care to show us the bad part of life and show us what we need not to do to get there. So I did sit on the electric chair because at the time I have some really bad thoughts in my mind. And if I would execute those thoughts, I could end up in jail or in the electric chair. So that's something that get my life straight and kept me away from trouble. And that's important, you know, to teach a young kid or young player all the side of life, the bad part. We need to see the bad part of life so we can stay away from it, you know.
What do you remember most about those 4 years you logged at LSU?
Oh, man. What I cherished the most of the 4 years, it was like being with the players, all the traveling abroad, the way the LSU treated the player. We were like, we stayed in the best hotel at that time, which the NCAA say it was illegal. We ate the best food. We have a great athletic department. We have our own athletic cafeteria. We have a nutrition doctor, you know, for each player. I mean, we had everything. We have the best of life, you know. We had, like, everything to make it in life. I mean, every day it counts. I stayed in Campo over the summertime, so I go work and earn me some money to help my family. I mean, there were so many helping people. And the LSU basketball team is not like, it's a family. Under the Dale Brown philosophy, we became a family, a truly family. You know, that's so great.
How's life been in the Dominican Republic for you?
Well, I'm not living in the Dominican Republic. I'm living in Brazil now. I have my family over there in Brazil. Life has been pretty good, have been really fair with me over there.
Are you in Rio or Sao Paulo?
I'm in Sao Paulo. I'm in the state of Sao Paulo.
The big city.
Interior of the state. Yeah. No, I'm not in the big city.
Well,
the big city is too big for me. I like more the inner city, you know, the countryside a little bit. So I'm in the state of Sao Paulo, but in the inner part of the state.
And you speak seven languages.
I speak seven languages today.
And I guess you're speaking a lot of Portuguese if you're in Brazil.
Of course. Of course, I do speak Portuguese.
Well, you've traveled the world, and it's taken a while for you to come back. I know people were wondering what happened to you, but you're obviously alive and well. You were 6'10", 225 when you arrived in LSU 40 years ago, and that's what you are right now. So you got some gas in the tank. What do you want to do with the rest of your life, Jose?
Well, what I want to do with the rest of my life is to take care of my family, take care of my wife, my kids, and help people, you know, the same way I was helped when I was younger. I want to do that now. And we've been doing that to different programs in the Dominican Republic. And hopefully we keep doing that. And, you know, life without people around, we are nothing. So we got to keep on trucking on that, you know.
I hear your friend and colleague, teammate John Williams, the great John Williams from Los Angeles, is having some issues. I know your heart goes out to him.
Of course. They always have some weight issues and weight problems, but may God bless him and help him find a way to fight those eating disorder, and all prayer to him, and whatever, if there is something that I can do to help him, I sure will do it, because he was a prized teammate and a great teammate to all of us, you know, to all of us. He was a brother to all of us, and he still is a brother to all of us.
Well, Jose, you've seen some of your players. You mentioned Greg Cook. He's now no longer with us. Your teammate, Don Redden. People die young sometimes, but sounds like you're around for a while. You're taking good care of yourself, and congrats on your success, and thanks for sharing your story once again with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Jim. And like I told you, you know, God gave to all of us the same thing.
Well, we were privileged to talk with you, and we're back after this 89.3-second timeout with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. Hope you're having a great holiday. And we're joined in studio now by an LSU professor of renown, 15 years at the Center for Computation and Technology, Supratik Mukhopadhyay. He is a native of the country of India, and he's doing some exceptional research here, trying to revolutionize chronic disease management by teaching an artificial intelligence engine to examine and analyze protein interactions. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
Well, how is this done with artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I think to go to there, I have to give you a little background. So I was doing research on drug discovery, and we actually were designing drugs for COVID. Before that, we went to the semifinal of the Artificial Intelligence X Prize, which is one of the top competitions in the world to solve moonshot problems. But after that, we realized the following. So, you know, well, there are two problems with drugs or medicines. One is you give medicines when people are sick, okay? Second is every medicine, whatever it is, has some side effects. So can we change the game? Then we thought that, can we change the game? So we are treating people when they're sick. Can we treat them before they're sick? And that brought us to this thing called wellness. Okay, can we treat wellness? So now wellness can be achieved by a lot of things. And especially, you know, chronic diseases like asthma, right, are not susceptible to treatment by drugs. So can we bring this wellness angle there? So artificial intelligence actually can help do that. So for example, there are things that can, for example, exercises, air quality, what kind of air you are breathing in, fasting, intermittent fasting. These are things that can help your health, and that can help manage chronic diseases. But you have to apply them in a very smart way. So you have to know exactly what you need, when you need, how much you need. And that's exactly where artificial intelligence can come into play.
All right. We're hearing the voice of Supratik Mukhopadhyay, professor in the Center for Computation and Technology at LSU, and leading the team trying to help revolutionize chronic disease management. Now, you mentioned exercise and diet, and those are things that we're well aware of, but how does this intersect with artificial intelligence?
Yes. So artificial intelligence basically can get your genomics data, can get your protein interaction data, and can analyze this protein interaction data and exactly tell you what kind of exercise you need, what kind of diet you need, diet, exercise, and for example, it can even guess that, okay, you're having a particular condition because of soil, so maybe because of mold, because of air quality, and can suggest, you know, appropriate mitigations.
Well, you're saying that this could revolutionize health treatment.
Exactly. Because, you know, what we're trying to do is basically provide the care before you're sick, as opposed to when you're sick, so that you don't become sick in the first place.
You say your goal is to extend a person's health span by providing customized wellness strategies based on the person's unique protein interactions. Now, you've got to have data going in, and how important is it to know what kind of shape the person's in before you take these AI steps.
Yes, it's very important to know what kind of, so that's why we use the test results from the person, as well as certain other information about the person, including the person's profile, everything we use, what kind of house they live in, and as well as get the protein interaction networks, the genomics data. And then based on that, we are trying to figure out what is it exactly. So health span means that the percentage of time in your life that you live healthy. So can we increase that percentage? So can we prevent you from falling sick? Can we predict that, okay, these are the diseases that will be coming or that will come to you maybe in so many years, right? And take precautionary actions so that those diseases do not come to you. In other words, mm-hmm. you never fall prey to those diseases.
The Deep Wellness Team, led by Dr. Mukhopadhyay, is working to identify critical pathways for immune-related diseases and longevity, both of which hold promise for health management. But as we know, we all respond differently. How do you factor that in? There is not one uniform way of analyzing a person's health.
Yes. So we are bringing in two types of information into the AI. So one is genomics information. Each of us have different genes. The second is context information. Context information includes a lot of stuff, like, for example, your age, gender, where you live, what kind of house you live, your social status, marital status, and a lot of other stuff. So including this, basically, including all these features, essentially uniquely characterizes you. So we are basically personalizing the AI so that it can exactly recommend things, for example, maybe intermittent fasting, mm-hmm. diets, and so on, that are specially suited to you and not for somebody else.
So by analyzing protein interaction networks, the researchers, including the doc, hope to gain insights into molecular mechanisms underlying autoimmune disorders like chronic inflammatory conditions and the aging process. So this is something that I'm sure is welcome. It is innovative. It could be revolutionary. How optimistic are you?
I'm very optimistic, actually. You know, the need is there. We need to change the way healthcare is done today. Today, you get the best care when you're lying on the bed dying. Right. Mm-hmm. That should not be how healthcare is provided, right? Healthcare should be provided so that you don't go into that condition. The percentage of time you live healthy of your life, that should increase. So we are optimistic that within in the near future, right, we should be able to revolutionize healthcare in a way that that can change the whole landscape so that even before you go to your doctor, the mitigations have already been in place.
This is done under the lead of LSU's Office of Innovation and Technology Commercialization, protecting and commercializing LSU's intellectual property. So there are all kinds of interlocking parts here. And you also have, I know a young man, Adam Bess, who's a computer sciences PhD candidate who's involved.
Right.
You wouldn't think medicine would involve a computer sciences guy, but when you're dealing with AI, it certainly does.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. AI is all pervasive today, you know, from drug discovery, healthcare, medical imaging, everywhere AI is involved. So we wanted to bring AI to wellness. Wellness, in other words, and that's what the deep wellness comes in. Deep wellness means apply AI in a way that revolutionizes healthcare. In the way I told you, right, that we prevent you from falling sick rather than giving you medicines after you fall sick.
Now, do other universities have similar programs? Are you using each other's research, or is LSU first in line here?
We are one of the first in the line here. There are a few other programs on the West Coast, and of course we are using that, but in the world, we are one of the first. This area.
Well, and LSU has the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, which is on the cutting edge of helping health matters in our country. But this is not affiliated with Pennington, but yet the goal is the same.
The goal is the same, except that Pennington does it in a clinical way, right? So we are basically trying to be a recommendation engine for Pennington.
What do you think the process will be like? What will it look like 5 years from now, Doc?
5 years from now, for example, you know, you'll have devices on your, let's say, hand or body. For example, in your, you can have an Apple Watch and so on. So that data will come in. You'll have your medical records and online, like in real time, the system can tell you how you're doing, mm-hmm. what you're supposed to do. Maybe you have missed your daily exercise. Maybe you have missed your, you have eaten too much. You have deviated from the diet that you should be. So basically keep you on the path so that, and recommend things that you should do so that eventually you are basically do not fall sick.
Well, we'll follow it with you. This is fascinating work, and it's being led by Dr. Supratik Mukhopadhyay, professor in the Center for Computation and Technology at LSU. It's been a pleasure and enlightening. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
And we're back with more Talk Louisiana after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster, and you're listening to Talk Louisiana on Labor Day. And we're privileged now to visit with psychiatrist Melvin Lurie, not just any psychiatrist. He's an honors graduate of Harvard. He's practiced and taught medical students not only at Harvard but at Tufts and has served as an expert witness, managed political campaigns, once even ran for office, and he's written a book, The Biology of Politics. Have you ever found yourself in a full-blown fight with a friend after a calm conversation turned to politics? This is relevant with the election 9 weeks from tomorrow for President of the United States and people at razor's edge as far as their temperament on some of the issues and people who are running for office. And good morning to you, Dr. Lurie.
Good morning. Morning.
Your thoughts about where we are now and why it's important to get some perspective before we destroy each other.
Well, that's really critical, and I think one way to do it, I hope one way to do it, is to look at politics from a different perspective. And that's what I've tried to do. And I've developed a system called the biology of politics. I think that what's been missing, and the reason that we keep repeating history, is because we don't look at the science of history, the biology of history. And the only way that's really shown to us currently or in real time is through politics.
Well, we have these people who, of course, if they're successful politicians, they're rather good at persuading the masses. But now I think we're in a position where we tend to believe only what we want to believe and discount other things. Is that a dangerous point of view or a dangerous perspective to have?
Well, I mean, to acknowledge it is absolutely true, and it's terrible. It's tearing our country apart. And one of the things I hope to achieve is to have people look at what's going on in politics from a different perspective, a scientific perspective, and hopefully that'll take away a lot of the anger because it'll really explain things at a much deeper level.
Well, when you talk about the biology of politics, Dr. Lurie, what are you referring to as far as what is within us affecting how we act and how we make decisions and treat each other?
Okay, so here's how it works. And, you know, the way that you best look at this is, the way you best look at this is to look at lower species because humans are too complicated. And when you do, you look at nesting species, which really are like us, and apply it to the family, and then apply it to the society, what you find is the two absolute imperatives of life, survival and reproduction, are at play. Survival we have to have in any species because it's not, we die out. And we have to have reproduction because, yes, adults die out and they have to be reproduced. And what's going on today is a fight between the issues of survival and the issues of reproduction. The issues of survival have to do with the ones we've known about forever, having resources, having a good economy, and protecting ourselves against internal and external invasion. This goes on in nesting species like birds and bees, and it goes on in the family, and it goes on with us. What isn't recognized, and this is a big part of the problem, is that a lot of what goes on in development of all of us is relatively unconscious, but it's playing a role, and it has more to do with reproductive development, which happened early in life and is carried on. And what are those things? So one of those things is that everyone in a family is equal. Well, you see this manifest in this equity movement today where everything has to be equal. You have the issue of cleanliness in a nest, in the family. There has to be cleanliness. And in fact, you see this in the environmental movement, which because our society has moved from survival to reproduction, this issue inside the nest can be expanded on, and we see how the environmental issue has gone so far that it's created a lot of difficulty with other issues, and it's cost us a fortune and a lot of controversy.
We're hearing the voice of Dr. Melvin Lurie, the author of The Biology of Politics. He notes that birds have an innate drive to protect their nest, and when some people talk about tightening the border, they're operating out of a deep drive to protect the nest. So is that a relevant comparison?
It is relevant, and just to extend it, there's another aspect of protecting the nest, the country, that isn't focused on as such, and that's the element of subversion. So a lot of what has infiltrated into society is similar to what comes in at the border, but it's harder to recognize it as such. But it's because of our lack of concern, relatively speaking, our lack of concern for protecting the nest that this occurs. Of course, the other half of society wants to continue to protect the nest, and there you go. They go at it like that.
Harvard psychiatrist Melvin Lurie, the author of The Biology of Politics. Now, the elephant in the room is Donald Trump, and he is a person many people like and may even love, and other people loathe him, but rarely do people have a neutral opinion about Donald Trump. How do you explain this?
Well, I think partly he creates what he really stands for in a biological sense is moving us back towards a survival mentality. And what his opponents stand for is moving us toward a more reproductive mentality. Unfortunately, if you don't have the ascendancy of the survival mentality, then you're vulnerable to internal and external attack and disintegration. And this is what I think is the missing piece and why we keep forgetting what happens in history and we repeat it. And I hope that's not where we're going now. I hope that we're not going to the end of our country and the end of our civilization, but there's real concern about that. And until we recognize what's underneath it, then we don't have a chance of fighting it.
Dr. Lurie, Donald Trump is a one-of-a-kind person, as we know. There's never been one quite like him in modern time as far as how he appeals and also repels the masses. But is he tapping into something, or is it him? It's hard to put the cart before the horse, but I'd like your thoughts about which came first, Trump, or were the people ready for somebody like Trump?
I think it's the latter. I think what Trump represents is moving more toward the survival mentality, the economy and the military and the law and order. These are ways of protecting ourselves and of generating wealth, food, resources for ourselves. And it's the other side that can't stand this. This is terrified for them for whatever reason. Now, you ask about Donald Trump, the person. I think there are two aspects to it. I think number one, many of his opponents use what's called identity politics. They just find any way to criticize him. You've heard of critical theory? This is critical theory. You find any way to criticize him. Remember, they criticized his wife's high heel shoes at one point, something not exactly relevant to life. But
he has done that to other people as well. It's not like he's being picked upon. I think people usually are responding to things he said. And I'm talking about Republicans. Remember when he ridiculed the appearance of Ted Cruz's wife and accused his father of killing JFK, and he called Marco Rubio Little Marco and Crooked Hillary. We go down the list. I remember Jeb Bush, when he was running against him in the first debate, said, "Donald, you will not insult your way to the presidency," but he did.
Yeah, he uses ridicule better than the Democrats, actually. It gets him in trouble sometimes, for sure. And he gets himself in trouble. I think one aspect of him, if you want to get involved in Donald Trump a little more, is Donald Trump likes to win, has to win. But if you win against small components, it's not much of a win. So he picks on the bureaucracy, you know, including the intelligence bureaucracy, which has a lot of power against him. He picks on the pharmaceutical industry. He did that about 6 weeks before the 2020 election. And he picks on big players. And if he beats them, then he's really got a victory. And I think that's part of his personality. But basically, he is a man of the media. He understands the media. And a lot of what he does, it's outlandish, gets reported on. So he's out there. So Donald Trump is out there for everyone to see, both sides of the aisle. And I think to a large extent, he does this on purpose. He creates animosity, but he does create a relationship with the population. And that's why it's so hot, because it's focused on him. He brings that upon himself because he understands the media, and he gets media attention by saying these outlandish, critical, ridiculing things.
Psychiatrist Melvin Lurie, the author of The Biology of Politics. Now, Dr. Lurie, I'm in a red state, although it's a blue city, but I encounter many people in my orbit who like Donald Trump. But you're at Harvard, and you're on the East Coast in a state in Massachusetts that's solidly blue. What do most people in your orbit think of Donald Trump?
Most people in my orbit don't talk about this. It's too hot.
Too hot.
Period.
Is that a good idea, or should they get it out of their system?
It's a bad idea, and that's why I'm trying to approach it from a different perspective, from a more scientific, a more biological, a more fundamental perspective. And when you look at it all through this prism, through this framework, you'll see things you never really saw before. I certainly have, and others have too that understand this. That's really a big problem that's going on. This red blue thing. It's really a dichotomy. There's some mechanisms that have caused it, such as, I don't know if you want to get into that, but there's some mechanisms that have caused it. But then it gets a life of its own.
Well, we want to have you back.
Can't talk about this.
Obviously, Kamala Harris, for other reasons, also stirs the passions of some who don't like what she stands for. But so hopefully we'll have Dr. Lurie back as we head closer to November 5th. But thanks for spending time with us on a holiday, sir, and good luck to you. Let's keep it going. Nice to meet you.
Okay, likewise.
This is Jim Inkster, and you're listening to the Labor Day edition of Talk Louisiana, and we're privileged to close our show on this holiday with George Sells, one of the most talented anchor people in the country, but he called Baton Rouge home on the air for 24 years as the primary anchor, along with Donna Britt, for WAFB Channel 9, which at the time was the highest rated television news program in the country, and it's still high. It always has been since George took over. And before we get to the topic at hand, George, when you arrived, that was not the case, was it, in 1988?
No, it was doing well. But it was not. It was number two behind WBRZ, but not by a lot. But we had periods by the time we got into the early 90s where we actually had three times the audience of the folks over at Channel 2. But I've always got to say, whenever I talk about that one of the reasons I came to Baton Rouge was because the market was so good in terms of news coverage, because of WBRZ and John Smain and the Manship family. They set the bar so high that everybody was doing a very good job. So it's not a matter of my great skill. We had to be skillful to compete with them, because they were good. Still are.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. They still are. And in television, you can be great, but as we know, viewing and listening, they're habits. And sometimes those habits go on for generations. And I listened to WAFB or watched WAFB because my dad did and my mom did and I grew up with it, or vice versa. And those habits sometimes have an inertia that is almost impossible to break through, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. And what we saw recently, last week or a week and a half ago, what the tragedy of that is, how it killed one of the great radio stations in America, WCBS in New York. You know, hundreds of jobs were lost when they actually gave up. I mean, imagine a radio station in New York with the call letters WCBS went off the air and gave their frequency, a 50,000 watt frequency, to somebody else because they could not cut it. The competition killed them. Because the habit in New York was to listen to 1010 Winds, WINS. And then I don't want to get too deep into shop talk here, but that was a battle that had been going on for 57, 58, mm-hmm. 59 years. And WCBS lost to another station. A station, by the way, for which my wife worked for a brief time.
Well, WCBS 880 was the radio home before they became television icons of Charles Osgood, Ed Bradley, Charles Kuralt. Back in the day, many television personalities, and of course, a lot of it had to do with the fact that radio was around first. Radio's been around since 1920, but many of them started in radio, and I think that was a great foundation for them.
Yeah, well, I mean, imagine we got a guy named Jim Engster here in town who could very easily do television when we keep his hair cut. No, you look good. You sound good. You do great television. And you're still young enough to do it.
So long as I get a haircut. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. You're right. But, you know, I think sometimes it's good to stand out. You know, I didn't intend for this to be about Donald Trump, but invariably we go there. But people for years have criticized his hair, but his hair is his signature. He wouldn't be Donald Trump without that hair, would he?
Well, you know, you look at pictures of him back in the early, it's hard to say the early 2000s, but he had brown hair and he was an entirely different looking guy. They make fun of his orange hair or his orange skin, his orange face and his blonde hair. But he's very distinctive looking now. I think he looks pretty good. That doesn't mean that I agree with his politics or how he's running his campaign, but he looks a lot better than he used to.
Well, and he's 78, and as we saw in the Democratic National Convention, William Jefferson Clinton has seen better days. Joe Biden's seen better days. Donald Trump has too, but I don't think anybody's going to use his lack of energy as a reason to vote against him. There are many other reasons why you might do that, but he has somebody who has energized news media. And the news media may not like Trump, many of the practitioners, but they certainly like the fact that people are watching them, listening to them, and reading what they do. And a lot of that is related to what they're reporting about Donald Trump.
Oh, they go crazy over it. Just last week, I mean, one of his campaign staffers or two of his campaign staffers and that incident in the National Cemetery in Washington, D.C. Trump wasn't even there. And everybody went wild over them trying to send a photographer to Area, 64, or whatever they called it?
60.
Area 60. Yeah, it's, well, whatever. It's. I think he's going to lose the election because he just will not. He will not stop shooting himself in the foot. These crass are actually dirty, dirty remarks. And I'm talking about dirty talk about his presidential opponent are just unheard of. The New York Times, I think, did a piece on his language his foul language about his opponent, using the term that we use now is DJ, but talking about I can't even say it on the radio in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
And I'd rather you not, but he was at Arlington last week, but we haven't seen the video of what happened, but it's one of those stories. And back in the day, a story like this might take a life of its own and go on for days and days and days, but Trump manages to change the subject. I remember when Trent Lott made a stupid statement at Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday that the country would have been better off if he had been elected in 1948. And by the way, he did carry Louisiana and Mississippi in 1948.
They are not different now. They are so different now that the rules have changed. And I think that's what many of the more thoughtful press writers, when they're allowed to do commentary, are pointing out to us. I just can't get a handle on it. And people like you are getting a handle on it. And thank heavens you're doing it by trying to go a little bit down the middle. But how do you do it?
Well, there will be a debate, it appears. They're jockeying back and forth, and Harris and Trump have a lot on the line because the debates sometimes are overplayed as to whether they really make a difference. But Harris will be introduced to the American people in a way she has not before. She did debate Mike Pence, but that's not the same. And Trump, of course, you never know. He's likely to be on his best behavior. It could be an all-out fracas, and then the question is, who does that help or hurt, George?
You know, he probably, he's going to surprise a lot of people. And by the way, just last Thursday, no, I'm sorry, last Wednesday or Tuesday it was, it became apparent that the debate is going to happen because ABC, which is carrying the debate, pulled out all the stops in promoting it. You know, there's been this question about she wants the microphones. I think she wants
on. She wants them on.
She wants them on.
At all times. Yeah. And he wants them off when the other person is speaking, which you would think it would be juxtaposed, but.
Yeah, you would. But the point is, we keep hearing stories about disagreements or delaying the final approval of the debate, but apparently ABC is sufficiently impressed with the fact that they do now have an agreement, and because they have gone all out to start promoting it as of last Tuesday. So it's going to happen on September 10th.
Yeah, a week from tomorrow night. So we're getting close. And Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are not shrinking violets. And I can only imagine, George, if he hovers behind her the way he did with Hillary Clinton, I don't think she's just going to stand there and not acknowledge that in some way.
That is one of the classic television debate techniques that spooked Hillary Clinton and will always go down in history. I've seen replays of that particular item of standing behind her, invading her space. Hillary Clinton, I'm talking about in 2016, that was a tool that I'm not sure he knew he was doing, but it was a powerful weapon.
And Albert Gore tried the same thing with George Bush. Remember, he walked over to him, and Bush looked at him like, are you crazy?
Yeah, exactly.
And Bush won. Of course, it was a very close election, as was Hillary and Donald. But this one shapes up as a close one, too. And the media will be a big part of it. And, George, I know we have you scheduled for your birthday, October 7th. A lot will happen between now and then.
Oh, yeah. Well, frankly, you know, using my skillful picking device in my brain, I'm afraid for the Republicans, it's going to be a loss. And I don't see how Trump can stop this bandwagon feeling that the Democrats have come out of their convention with.
Well, George, have to go, but we'll be talking again next month. Thank you. Always an honor and pleasure to visit with the great George Sells. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
And back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.